we go. So, as mentioned, I'm going to go ahead and talk now about our next topic, which relates to the complying with the Missouri redacting rules for case.net. This is an area, interestingly enough, I will tell you, when we sent out the email on Monday indicating to people we were talking about redactions on case.net, we had about 440 people signed up, and the last time I looked, we had about 950 people signed up. So we added 500 people in about 3 days, I think because people are worried about how this works. And so that was a reason I thought it makes sense for us to go ahead and cover this pretty much in detail. I'm going to get into the weeds here. This is going to be some very specific information, but it will help you hopefully comply with the redaction requirements. And again, making sure that you're protecting the information of your clients and, frankly, the information of opposing parties as we do put things out into CaseNet. The reason for this, you may be aware, is that about a year ago, the Missouri Supreme Court made a decision that they wanted to really make sure that the system was open. And what they did basically there was to provide that everyone would have access to filed pleadings through the CaseNet system, whether they were a lawyer or not. So as you may remember or may know, prior to July 1st of this year, if you were a lawyer, you would generally be able to get a login, you could log in, and you could access pleadings. So if Paige filed a notice of deposition, I could see the docket entry that said a notice of deposition had been filed. I could also go in and I could actually open up that notice of deposition. Or if she filed a motion, I could open up and see the motion. If you did not have a password, if you were not a Missouri licensed lawyer and did not have a password, you generally could not actually see the pleadings. You could only see the docket. The Missouri Supreme Court decided to change that policy and make it so that now every court filing will be open going forward. If you remember, they actually did try to make it retroactive, but they realized it was going to be a huge problem because there was so much confidential information in these court filings that wasn't protected. And because it wasn't protected, if we made all of the records open, you know, from the dawn of case.net, which is about 10 years or 20 years, we'd have huge problems. Everybody's Social Security number would be on there. Lots of people's Social Security numbers, their private cell phone numbers, you know, names of children involved in criminal activity or abuse situations, those types of things. And they said, wait, we can't do it going backward, but we are going to do it going forward. So as of July 1st, every filing has to comply with the redaction requirements. And also starting on July 1st, they rolled out public access to the filings. So there's sort of two things going on. There's what do the lawyers need to do? And the answer there is as of July 1, we needed to comply with the redaction requirements. And there's what are the courts doing? And you can see here that on July 1st, the Supreme Court and the Courts of Appeal made all of their filings filed on July 1 and after open. And then on July 16th, the 1st through the 11th circuits open. On August 20th, the 12th through the 21st circuits have become open to the public. And then you can see there on September 17th, the 22nd through 29th, and then on or after October 22nd, the 30th through the 46th. And the people that are bringing this in, so it's the Supreme Court, the Office of State Court Administration, also known as OSCA, they have staggered this because they weren't sure how much the public burden would be on the computer system, and they said we may need to delay it if the system has been too burdensome. I haven't heard problems about that, so I believe it's basically opening on time. But again, we need to file redacted documents now, and those documents will become available through this. Information, whatever you file in the document will be seen. So, for example, if you file an order of judgment that has, you know, what somebody did wrong, what their Social Security number is, what their residence is, what amount they need to pay, that type of information, all of that is going to be available. So, you know, realize, again, that as we're filing things now, you should presume that anything you put in case.net, if you don't redact it in some way, shape, or form, is going to need to be publicly available. So again, as we think about, you know, protecting our clients' information, not disclosing information unless it's impliedly authorized or unless it's with client consent, we're needing to take steps to protect their information going forward. Now, in that context, one of the things to understand is that there are different levels of security for Missouri courts. You can see the security levels 1 through 9. I was actually really happy to see this because, frankly, I didn't realize that they had a nice public listing of them. But you can see status 1 is public information. Status 2 is public or partially public information. And then you can see there, starting with level 3, it becomes confidential, open to court staff and attorneys of record and parties registered for e-filing. And that is what most filings used to be. As the big thing to realize now is that that's changing. Now, most filings are instead going to be level 1, where everything is available. So as we talk about redaction, a lot of times what it is it's simply moving things to level 3 security because they do contain that confidential information. You notice then level 4 is confidential, available only to select court personnel and attorneys of record. You can see, for example, juvenile or mental health records. Then you have level 5, which is, you know, even more sequestered or protected, and it goes all the way up to level 9, which it would be for expunge cases after the expungement order has been entered. And you can see that's only open to OSCA and to court personnel. So again, things are really getting narrowed down as you go up these levels of confidentiality. What happens with regard to the redaction rule is that they specify certain information must be protected. This is, as you can see, something that's actually adopted in 4 separate rules. First of all, it's Court Operating Rule 2.02C has this language in it. Also, rules 19.10, 55.025, and 84.015 all have identical or almost identical provisions in them. And the reason for that is, of course, because Rule 19 deals with criminal proceedings in the trial courts, Rule 55 deals with civil proceedings in the trial courts, and Rule 84 deals with appellate courts. And so they had to adopt this rule in 3 different places. The largest and most comprehensive rule is Court Operating Rule 2.02. It has this provision and has some other important things in it we'll talk about in just a moment. But the basic key language is all the same. They say that, you know, information that needs to be redacted includes but is not limited to Social Security numbers, driver's license numbers, state identification numbers, taxpayer ID numbers, and passport numbers. All of those need to be protected. Financial institution account numbers, credit card or debit card numbers, personal PIN numbers, and passwords used for accessing financial accounts. Name, address, and contact information of informants, victims, witnesses, and persons protected under restraining orders, protective orders. Dates of birth, names of individuals known to be minors, and case numbers of confidential expunged or sealed records. And you notice there filers should exercise caution when filing documents that include medical records, employment histories, financial records, proprietary information, or trade secrets. So all of this information, they're saying, you know, make sure you redact these things, and you may need to redact more. And I will tell you, Paige and I had an appellate filing recently where we were filing exhibits that included exhibits related to a minor who was known as a Doe party in a litigation. The redacting literally took hours. The filing, I think, probably took hours, too. Paige will tell you that I think she's probably still, you know, receiving mental health treatment for it. It was a mess. But anyway, we got it done. And so we have lived through the fight, and we're here to help you all hopefully live through the fight a little bit easier than we did. But again, this is the list of the minimum stuff that needs to be required. And again, the idea here is to protect confidential information. You'll see that, unfortunately, you know, I think the general rule people say is when in doubt, redact, which is a good rule to a point, but you'll see it gets carried to extremes a little bit. One interesting thing to know is that actually, as the Supreme Court was going through this, they did have to tweak their list a little bit. And the reason was because the legislature actually adopted a statutory provision that also relates to protecting information in court pleadings. And I've included that here in part just because I think it's really interesting. It is Missouri Revised Statute 509.520, subsection 1. And you'll notice it lists basically the exact same information that we listed on the prior slide for what the rules, Rule Court Operating Rule 2.02, and then Rule 19.10, 55.025, and 84.015. And I'm not probably going to keep referring to all of those rules, but you'll hear as we kind of go through, that's where we are. The other thing to mention is that there is a different Supreme Court Rule 2. Supreme Court Rule 2 actually is the judicial canons, and so that's why this is Court Operating Rule Number 2. It's a different rule than Rule 2. Okay. Now, interestingly enough, you'll notice there was a question about state identification numbers, and you may be wondering what state identification numbers are. Well, this is sort of a preview for a program in December. We'll be talking about artificial intelligence, and so I thought Paige and I are testing out some artificial intelligence. Particularly, this is from Case Tech's co-counsel, and I asked it. I said, in Missouri, what does the term state identification number mean? And you'll see it gave me a query, and it gave me a response and says, there does not seem to be a single universally accepted definition of state identification number under Missouri law. And then it goes on to talk about voter registration system does identify unique number and things like that. Well, interestingly enough, I then called OSCA and checked this morning, and they agree that state identification number is not a defined term. What they intended it to be was really state ID numbers. So you think about a driver's license, and you may know that there are also IDs that you can get if you're not a driver. It's, I think, just called a state identification card or something. That's really what they're talking about. One of the questions that I received in preparing for today's program asked, do bar numbers need to be protected? And the general answer, the expected answer there is no, bar numbers do not need to be protected. What is the method of redaction? They don't specify what exactly needs to be done, but they do want you to make it clear that information has been redacted. Normally, the two preferred methods are to cover things with black or to cover things with a white box that has the word redacted in the middle of it. If you're printing a lot of things, you'll find that the white boxes are really nice because if you make things black, you know, it prints black, 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 and it wears off on your fingers and everything else, depending upon your printer. You'll kill your toner a lot faster. But if you are doing things in general, and often just small redactions are going to be done usually with black ink, you know, that covers over it. One of the other things is that there is discussion that in some instances you'll need a generic identifier. So, for example, if you're referring to a minor by name in a document, you may want to just put the minor's initials as something you would cover over. That may be something where you're cutting and pasting, you know, little white boxes with the person's initials over their name in the documents, which, again, can take quite a while. So one of the things I would caution you if you're going through redactions is realize, leave enough time for yourself to get this done or realize you may need to file a motion to get additional time. What about disclosing redacted information? Well, when you do redact information in the pleading, you're supposed to contemporaneously file what is known as a confidential redacted information filing sheet, or a CRIFS, or what you will also hear is a CRIFS. And the CRIFS will either indicate that an unredacted version of the document has been filed or set out the information that has actually been redacted. And you will see, we're going to use examples of the CRIFS in just a moment as I walk you through this, but CRIFS are something we're all going to be spending a lot of time talking about very soon. Responsibility for redacting does rest solely upon the person who filed the document. You'll see that the court rules state that courts are not responsible for this, and so if things are inappropriately redacted, it is the responsibility of the party who filed it, and if you see something, you're going to have to ask the person who filed it to fix it or file a motion with the court to have the redactions improved or the information concealed. And then the other thing to know is if you are filing things, and I put the language in red here because this is actually from Rule 2.02, but that same language does not appear in Rules 19.10, 55.025, and 84.15, but all filers generally need to certify their compliance except for court personnel. Normally how this is done if you are filing using the CaseNet system as an attorney is when you get ready to actually submit a document, it will ask you to check a box indicating that you have satisfied the redaction requirements of the document and that it does not include any information that should be redacted. Now, what if there's a dispute over redactions? And this is one of the unique provisions in Court Operating Rule 2.02E4. It does indicate that when a motion is filed alleging a document contains insufficiently redacted information, the clerk should immediately increase the document's security level to a confidential setting. So the expectation would be they would move it up to a level 3, which means that only the court and counsel of record could see it, and the parties. And you can see there the court shall dispose of such motions within 30 days. If the court determines the document is sufficiently redacted, the court shall reset the document to allow proper public access, generally, again, being that level 1 or level 2 access. Now, as I was asking people for examples of questions and things, one person said to me, I'm seeing documents where basically everything is being redacted. And I said, if you could send me an example, I'd love to get it. So you can see this was actually filed in St. Francois County at Farmington, and it's in the case of NRE, and we don't know because they redacted the name of the case. They redacted comes now blank attorney and hereby withdraws as counsel for blank and comes now so-and-so and enters as counsel for the party. The red here was actually redacted by the person who sent me this document, but all of the black here was actually redacted by the person who filed this. As best as I can tell, none of this stuff should have been redacted, except perhaps if there was a minor's name that should have been redacted. But this is an example where you know, parties to litigation, that's still public information, again, unless they're minors or unless it's an order of protection or something else where that identity is concealed. Normally, attorneys' names are not something that needs to be redacted. Also, attorneys' addresses don't need to be redacted, and attorneys' bar numbers don't need to be redacted. This is one question I actually had from a couple of people is, does that state identification number mean a bar number? And the answer, I believe, is no, and it seems like OSCA supports that position. Bar numbers actually are publicly available through the Missouri Bar website for every lawyer. So no, I don't think you need to redact your phone number, your address, and other things. This is a document where, frankly, the person probably went too far. Don't know if they're on the program today, but if you see this as you're pleading, you can say, oh, I guess I shouldn't have redacted all that. And again, the red on this was actually sent by, was done by the person who sent it to me, so that the opposing, so that you all couldn't see whose it was. Okay. That gets us to the interesting part of today's program, which is I've come up with 11 steps for the proper filing of confidential information. And I'm going to walk you through this because I can tell you I've made mistakes already, and I'm going to hope that you can avoid some of these same mistakes. So if you've got a pleading that has some information you need to redact, the first thing to do is make is you're going to need to have two copies of the document. So you can see here, prepare an unredacted document, so you've got something with all the stuff in there, and then make a copy. In this particular instance, I'm using this ABA ethics opinion that we just talked about, opinion 507, but you can see there we've got the blue copy and we've got the red copy, and the red copy is going to be the one we're going to redact. So we have two copies of the document. We then redact the appropriate information on the copy where we want redactions to occur. Now, I'm going to go ahead and spend the time walking you through how to do redactions because we see lots of people making mistakes. And you'll see the mistake that people make in just a moment. In order to do this, I have to pick a software. And I happen to choose Adobe Acrobat Pro. To give you a sense of how, of my evening, I was actually getting ready to post my slides last night when Adobe Acrobat Pro changed its format. So I actually had to update these last night. So you're getting the brand new format for Adobe Acrobat. And if you're looking at it and thinking, why is it different? The reason is probably because you haven't used it since about midnight last night. When I went to use it to actually shrink my slides down, I realized, oh, crap, they've changed it. So this is the new one. So if you're going to redact something, the first thing to do is open it up in a system that allows for redactions. In my case, again, I'm using Adobe Acrobat Pro. It's about $200 a year. It works really well. It does lots of cool things, so it's a great program. This is the brand new format. And you'll notice there that on the left, there's at the very far left-hand corner, it says All Tools. And if you click on that, you get an All Tool menu, and you can see the menus rolling down that left-hand side. Now, if you've got good eyes or if your slides are big enough, you can see one of those is called Redactive PDF, and we'll be going there in just a moment. Okay. In fact, actually, there is the Redactive PDF. So you click on that, and it will then allow you to select text and mark it with red. So what I did then was I just dragged my cursor over, and it marked that in red. You'll notice at the bottom there, there's a blue Apply button. And when I've marked what I want redacted, you can apply it. I will give you a hint that if you've got a long document where you're going to be redacting a bunch of different things, you may want to redact some of it, you know, mark it in that those red boxes, hit Apply, then continue redacting through the document. Otherwise, if something happens where you mess it up, you might lose all of your redactions, which is bad. But again, you're doing this to the copy that you intend to redact, and you're keeping an unredacted copy unmarked. Okay. Then you click that Apply button, and this is what happens to it. It takes what you could see as text there, and it covers it, in this instance, with black, so you can't see anything below it. Now, you may be thinking, wait, I've got this really clever way to do this. I can just highlight it with black, and that works great. And the answer is no, it does not. If you're using the highlight function, and you can see here I've used green, yellow, and pink, highlight does mark text. It does make it sometimes easier to read or harder to read, but the key thing is highlight leaves the underlying text still there. So even if I had highlighted these documents with black text, the underlying text would still be there. It can be copied and pasted out from underneath the highlighting. I don't necessarily expect you to understand the technical merits of this. The big thing to understand is if you're using a highlight feature, that doesn't redact. The general rule and what I would really encourage you is use something that has the word redact or redacting or redaction in its name. If it's called, you know, the redacting application or the redacting tool, it's going to redact. If it's called the highlighting tool, it's not going to redact. So please don't use highlight. I can tell you I've seen cases involving former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. I've seen cases involving CIA witnesses where people use the highlight function and thought they were redacting. Again, it doesn't redact, so please don't do it. Okay. So we've redacted the document. Then we need to complete a CRIFS, or a Confidential Redacted Information Filing Sheet. This is Form 135, or F-135. It is available on the Internet. This is intended to be the basic form there. You can see it asks for the party name, the case number, some other information. And you have two different ways that you can fill this out. The first is you can actually fill out the information, and you can indicate what you've redacted. For example, in the document, I substituted the term John Doe, and instead what I'm doing is I'm hiding Jimmy Jones's name, so I put Jimmy Jones there. And you don't actually have to list that it's the name of a minor. I did because I'm explaining to you what I'm doing. But you can see there I filled out the sheet, and I went ahead and said, okay, I'm redacting, and I'm using this generic identifier there of John Doe, and that's actually covering up for Jimmy Jones. Now, it could be, you know, I change it to SS dollar sign, and that's for the Social Security number. I would then put the Social Security number over on the right-hand side. So if it's 123-45-56789, I would put that redacted information, the Social Security number, actually on the CRFs. And importantly, when you file the CRFs, as we'll see, it does go in as a Level 3 document. It's got security, so you're not making that information public. Now, I will mention here also, I like Adobe. It's kind of cool. I don't get paid by Adobe at all. Don't worry. But this was actually filled using the Adobe Fill and Sign tool, which allows you to basically turn all of those boxes into things you type in. So it's a very easy way to work with it, and again, you know, things you can learn. Okay, the other thing you can do with a CRF sheet is you can not list all the information, but simply check a box indicating that you're filing an unredacted copy of the document. And so you can read the whole thing. It says, the unredacted document is attached to this filing sheet in place of listing the redacted information identifiers below. So you can just check that box, and then you can attach the unredacted document to the back of the pleading. This is why you need that second copy. You file the redacted version, and then you're going to file the CRF sheet with the unredacted copy as an exhibit, and you'll see how that works in just a moment. Okay, the next thing to do is to check your file size. Each file, each pleading, each document, exhibit, attachment, whatever, needs to be 7 megabytes or smaller, and the combined filing may not exceed 21 megabytes. Sometimes you need to actually break your filings up. We had one set of exhibits, I think, that were 126 pages and were something like 30-something megabytes. It ended up becoming 3 segments because that was the best we could do to get it filed. But you'll, again, want to make sure that you have things that are the right size. One of the other ways to get things the right size is you can sometimes compress a PDF. And this may be your bonus points for today's program and why you're here. Again, under Adobe Acrobat, it used to be that you could actually see the Optimize tool. Under the new format, it seems like what you do is if you look kind of at the top right there, you'll see Find Text or Tools. If you type in the word compress there, it will allow you to pull up compressing a PDF. And you can see here I clicked on that, and then it asked me, you know, how do I want to save it? It allows me to change the name. I can save it over the old document. And this will literally shrink the size of a PDF. How much does it shrink it? It varies. It varies upon what settings you're using. It also varies upon what the document is. To give you an example, today's slides are about 7 megabytes. When I ran them through Adobe Acrobat Pro and optimized them, they were down to about 2 megabytes. So if you've got a document that's 10 megabytes and you want to get it down to under 7, compressing it will probably do the trick. It won't always do the trick, but it will probably do the trick. And it's certainly worth doing because it's a lot easier to do than to try to divide things up into part 1, part 2, part 3, which you can again do by, you know, taking a PDF and copying it and then deleting certain pages from copy 1 or copy 2 so that you have part 1 and part 2. Definitely not a very fun thing. By the way, if you're giving your assistant this to do, you're like, hey, we've got a filing today. You're leaving at 5, it's 4:40, and you've got to, you know, do these redactions and things, you're probably killing them. They probably hate you right now. This stuff takes a lot of time. Paige spent, 2 hours on Monday morning getting the exhibits redacted and filed. You know, if you're going to need this stuff done, get it done ahead of time. You know, get your motions for additional time on file. Certainly the courts will realize this is a good reason to do things. I know I worked at some firms where people were really good at walking up to their assistant at like 4:58 when the assistant was supposed to leave at 5 and saying, hey, I've got a filing due today. You know, in those days, the courthouse is sometimes closed. You know, now at least we've got until midnight, but realize this stuff does not happen quickly. And yes, this is being recorded, so if you're a person who works with an attorney like that, you want to send them a copy of this, you can send it to them later. You know, we spent hours redacting those exhibits. There were a lot of them. You know, it was very complicated. We had to go through a special needs trust and redact a name of a child everywhere it appeared. It was a nightmare. But anyway, you know, this stuff takes time, and please give people the time to do it. Okay, so once you've got your redacted document, you've got your unredacted document, you've got your CRFs, you then go into CaseNet. And the first document you file is you file the redacted document. And you file it just like you would any old pleading. You can see here, you know, this is an appellate brief. We actually did file. I went ahead and sampled this through again. So you can see there, document category, brief appellant, document type, appellant. And then you'll see there it's got a name. It's the name of the file is brief redacted, so we didn't file the wrong thing. You can see there the document has actually now been uploaded as brief redacted. It's only 0.28 megabytes. It is ready to go. Now, this is the interesting thing, step 7. If we're going to use a CRFs, the best thing to do is right now click Add New Document. Don't click Continue. That's what I did, and I'll explain what that does in just a moment. But if you click Add New Document, you can now connect the unredacted version and the CRIFS sheet with that document. So we filed the redacted brief. We're going to be able to connect the unredacted brief to this document. If instead you click Continue, you can file the redacted version as one document. You can file the CRIFS as a separate entry in the CaseNet, but you can't associate the two of them, which is one of the things you're supposed to do. So when I filed things initially, I filed the unredacted brief, and then I hit, you know, click, 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 submitted the document, then started over and filed the unredacted brief with a CRIFS sheet. They ended up not being able to be associated by me because I had gone all the way through the process of submitting the brief. So again, at this point, what you want to do is you want to hit Add New Document, and then you'll pick a type of document that has a red padlock. If you choose the redacted information filing sheet, now why they don't call it the confidential redacted information filing sheet, I don't know. They cut off the word confidential, so it's no longer a CRIFS, but it is a CRIFS. If you select that from the document type, it will automatically populate the top category with filing other miscellaneous. And seeing that red padlock there means when I file this document, it's going to be filed as a level 3 security document. So at this point, I go, okay, I've selected the type I need to associate, and I can actually associate it to my brief because, again, I hit Add New Document at this point. So I associate it to the brief so it knows, okay, we filed a redacted document. Now we're going to file an unredacted document. And then I can go ahead and file it through. I'm going to skip over that slide. I'll come back to it in just a second. So at this point, I went ahead and I uploaded the CRIFS sheet as the document, and then as the attachment, I did the unredacted appellant brief. So you'll notice there that the CRIFS sheet has been entered, the appellant's brief, and by the way, on that CRIFS sheet, I checked the box saying that this is going to be, that I'm going to just accompany it with the unredacted document, so I didn't have to list all the confidential information there, and this is going to cause it to be linked to that document. Now, you'll notice at the bottom it's here, all documents and attachment size 1.74 megabytes of 21 megabytes. So they have the size of each document. They're all below 7 megabytes. The combined total, below 21 megabytes. We're good. We can go ahead and proceed with filing this. If you instead were trying to file something that where the type of file was such that you didn't need to secure the document, you would get a notice that says you have selected a case type where docket entries will only be visible to secured users. So this is telling you you don't have to worry about filing the CRIFS sheet or the padlock document. This particular slide actually came from a video that the Missouri Supreme Court makes available and the Missouri Bar makes available, which I'll provide the link to later, but that's why it says Robert Abbott, this is their case. But anyway, it will tell you if you don't need to file things under security. Okay, so at this point we have uploaded the redacted brief. We have then added a new document and we have uploaded the CRIFS sheet, and then as an attachment to the CRIFS sheet, we have attached the unredacted appellate brief. Now, the CRIFS sheet and the appellate brief, unredacted, are both going to be filed under that red document, the red padlock document type, which means they're going to be protected. So I can file them, and they will not be exposed to the public. Okay. Then complete the filing by hitting Continue and then getting ready to submit it. When you do submit it, you're going to have to check that box indicating that things are that you've satisfied the certification requirement, and then hit submit, and it will submit it. And then you'll notice here I say breathe calmly and congratulate yourself, because I think that's what people should always do when they file on CaseNet. But certainly if you're filing redacted documents, it is a real relief when you get things filed. But anyway, that is how you do it. And hopefully you've walked through that. Now, a couple of things to mention. You know, are there issues with redaction? The answer is absolutely yes. What are some of those issues? Well, do the court staff check redactions? The answer is no. You are responsible as the filer of the document to make sure redactions are correct. People have told me they've gone on to systems and realized that a lot of lawyers are not doing this right. That is certainly true. That's how redactions have always been. But realize the rules do require this, and there are potential issues, including Melinda Bentley, who's the Missouri Legal Ethics Council, wrote an article saying, you know, this may be something where if you don't redact properly, you could be in violation of a court rule or court order, which under Rule 4-3.4 means it's an ethics violation. So be careful there. But, you know, realize this is something where you have to handle it. Does black highlighting work? No. You know, I just showed you highlighting doesn't work, and I said if the name of the tool you're using does not include redact or redaction or something like that, you are using the wrong tool. If you absolutely can't figure out how to redact things, you can still use black markers, but make sure they are dark enough, and then you would need to scan the documents in. And by the way, that's just a mess anyway, so that's probably not the best way to do it. Redaction tools are not hard to get. There's some inexpensive apps that you can use, or you can use, you know, just normal PDF type things, and it will help you out immensely.
What if opposing counsel messes up the redaction? Well, the first thing is, you know, realize this is hard. So try to be professional, call them and see if they can fix the problem. Sometimes you can actually withdraw a filing and refile it. If that's not going to work, you will need to file a motion and then rely upon Court Operating Rule 2.02E4 that you know then the court is supposed to lock the document up while you guys litigate it, and ultimately it may in fact require additional redactions to be done. And that will protect the thing, and it should be decided within 30 days. Are there different rules for probate, et cetera? The answer, I put no here, but that's not really true. As I mentioned, there are some types of court filings that are already secure. So if they're already secure, you don't need to worry about it. But for, in general, you know, these rules, it's Rule 19, Rule 55, and Rule 84. All the courts are governed by these rules. So unless the proceeding itself has higher protections, you are going to need to do things. And you'll see attendees report that people are doing lots of inconsistent things. For example, you know, if you're not supposed to be filing the names of children, you're supposed to be using initials or something else. You know, those are things that, again, you're supposed to do under the rules. Does state identification numbers include Missouri bar numbers? There is no apparent definition of this. Missouri bar numbers are available through the Missouri bar website, so probably not. And as I said, I checked with OSCA today, and my understanding of their answer was no. What they're talking about there with state identification numbers is like state ID cards. Bar numbers are not something that need to be redacted. Is a redacted copy a true and accurate copy? Someone said, you know, how are we going to say attaches a true and accurate copy? Well, the interesting thing here is that either you're providing the crypt sheet or you're providing an unredacted document. I think the best thing to do is if you're going to say attaches a true and accurate copy, you file a redacted copy publicly, you file the unredacted copy again as part of that add a new document filing. It's going to then be part of it. It's just not going to be the first attachment. It's going to be the second attachment. But I think then you're okay saying, yes, attaches a true and accurate copy. So provide that and you're good there. Can you use a program other than Adobe Acrobat? The answer is absolutely. You can use any program, again, but you want something that uses the word redaction. This particular chart, and it actually runs over the next three slides, was provided by a computer consulting group called Affinity. It is available on their website. I actually know a lot of the Affinity people. They're good people in general. They've got some prices here for different types of software that you can use. I also mentioned there are some apps that you can use. You can kind of look around. This has different features, you'll notice, of what works and what doesn't work. The most important thing to realize here is the first column is Adobe Acrobat Reader. That is a free program. Next to it is Adobe Acrobat Standard and then Adobe Acrobat Pro. Notice when you look at the Adobe Acrobat Reader, if you look at what features it has, it doesn't have many features. It is a free program. It does not provide for a redaction. So, you know, realize that's not going to be the tool you're going to want. You're going to probably have to pay a little something to get a redaction tool, but it's not a big deal. It is certainly worth doing. And if you're wondering, you know, where can I find this chart where it's not divided over three slides, on slide number 74, I do have the links, so you have everything there, and you can pick your own program. But again, I wanted to make sure I walked people through how to use at least one of them. Okay. You know, why can I not find Redact on my free PDF viewer? The problem is probably because it doesn't have that function. So you're probably going to have to pay some money. Doesn't need to be a lot of money. You know, again, Adobe Acrobat's 200 and something bucks a year, and it does have a good redaction tool that it will destroy the computer information under the redaction, so there's no way anybody can get it. Highlighting, again, does not work. Okay. Should clients receive redacted or unredacted versions? There's an update video provided by the Missouri Bar on its website, and it says there that ordinarily a party is allowed to receive a non-redacted copy, but the lawyer should exercise some discretion. They say, for example, a respondent in an order protection case should not be given information about an alleged victim's address. You know, think about what sort of information is there. Your client probably doesn't need the Social Security number. You know, think about what you're doing. But again, the normal consensus there is that clients are parties and are allowed to see information that is filed with redactions. Okay. A couple additional resources. The Missouri Bar does have a website. I've provided a bit.ly link there. You can click on that to go. And they do include a video about how to go through this process that I thought was pretty good. I provided a link to that as well. That is the general video of how to file things, to file the crypt sheets and the redacted documents, et cetera, as I just walked you through. The last thing I'm going to mention before I turn off things, we are asking now if people are willing to support our webinars, that you consider giving a donation. You can mail something in, or if you'd like to do it through a credit card. There is a link on the website, or link on the slides now, or you can go to bit.ly/dlgwebinars and provide a donation. That allows us to keep our programs free. And I'm going to look because I know I've gotten several emails, and I was ignoring them, but only halfway. It says, do you have information regarding redactions for drivers under 18 for traffic violations? I mean, the thing is, if it's a protected file, you know, then you're okay. But if it's a public file, you are going to need to redact things. So, you know, again, these rules, the rules that they provided in COR 202 and in rules 1910 and 55, you know, et cetera, those really do come straight across from each type. So short answer is that should not change things. Apple Preview comes free with Mac OS. Yes, we use it. I don't think it has a redaction tool. Oh, Paige says actually it does have a redaction tool, so yes, that would be something. You know, obviously it's not really free because you're buying the Mac OS system. Paige and I both use Preview a lot. Preview makes it very easy to delete pages from a PDF, which is great, so certainly worth considering. It asks, is it an ethics violation to over-redact, or is it an ethics violation only to under-redact? Over-redaction could be interfering with giving someone access to information. It could constitute a violation of the rules. It's not terribly likely. Let's see. Someone says, I recently saw something that instead of filing a redacted copy of a pleading to instead file just the CRIFs along with an unredacted copy, is this allowed? I think the short answer there is no. If the pleading, I mean, you can obviously file it as part of things, but you need to actually file an unredacted copy of the pleading. Otherwise, you're avoiding the public access to the file. So if you say, I'm never going to file anything public and redacted, I'm only going to file CRIF sheets with pleadings attached, sooner or later somebody's going to come to you and say, hey, you're not providing public information. This is not acceptable. So, you know, it may last for a while. Judges may be confused too, but realize you're probably going to run out of time on that one. Somebody's upset about using CRIF sheets. Don't know what to tell you there other than, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. And then what about, you know, redacting accusations and stuff? The short answer there, again, is, you know, I think you've got to be careful what you're going to redact and not redact. Certainly if you're, you know, alleging someone has mishandled certain proprietary information, you're going to get into the details of that. You may want to redact it. We actually redacted home email addresses and people's cell phone numbers unless they were things that were already on signature blocks of lawyers. So we didn't worry as much about business email addresses. Let's see. Says, is it your opinion that COR2 only requires a redacted copy of an exhibit filed with the petition and then you file the CRIFs with the unredacted copy? The answer there is yes. You know, you are not supposed to file the unredacted copies with your petition unless there's something, unless there's nothing there that needs to be redacted. Is the consensus that the name of any non-party must be either redacted or no? I don't think that's consensus at all. Generally, you know, there are certain types of cases where victims and witnesses need to be protected. In general, I don't think it's correct that everybody needs to have all the names redacted. But again, you know, things to know, but I don't think that's the case. Okay. Lots of other questions. How do we get this court to raise the security level? None I've asked have been willing to do it. You can file a motion, actually, to have things changed. We actually did have one case that was moved to, like, a level 7 or level 9 or something. It was really up there. We were very pleased about that. Doesn't always work, but it's certainly worth doing. I think I've hit most of the questions, so I'm going to go ahead and move forward, which is the good news is that I'm going to end the recording.